U.S. college students get Google Gemini's Pro plan free for 1 year and use the best model in the world for multimodal understanding. So whether you're uploading a video to get feedback on your presentation, uploading a photo of your homework to ask for extra help, or transcribing notes from a lecture you missed, Gemini 3 Pro can help. I'm honestly so happy and excited for all the college students out there because I wish this was around back when I was in school. This is such a game changer and so useful. I'm honestly a little jealous. So if you want to try it out, sign up to get more access to Google's most accurate model, Gemini 3 Pro. Unlimited image uploads, pro-level image editing, higher limits in Notebook LM, Gemini in Gmail and Docs, 2 terabytes of storage, and more. All you have to do is visit gemini.google/students to learn more and sign up. Terms apply.
If you run a Shopify store, listen up. Shopify's got you covered for selling, but when your shipping volume grows and you're juggling multiple plugins just to get orders out the door, you need tools that can keep up. Stop duct taping your shipping workflow and use the tools that work better together, like Shopify and ShipStation. Think of ShipStation as Shopify's dedicated shipping partner. ShipStation goes beyond just shipping labels to save you time and money by automating the entire order fulfillment process, from syncing your orders all the way through inventory management and returns. Automate the rate browser to select the lowest rates on shipments, with discounts up to 90% off major carriers like USPS, UPS, and FedEx. No wonder businesses that use ShipStation grow 3 times faster on average and ship 15 times more orders. See how ShipStation can help you scale and boost your Shopify sales. Go to ShipStation.com and access all features free for 30 days. No credit card or contract required. Cancel anytime. That's ShipStation.com.
At around 2:15 a.m. on June 7th, 1992, 18-year-old Stacy McCall and 19-year-old Susie Streeter returned to Susie's home in Springfield, Missouri after a night out of graduation celebrations. Susie's mother, Cheryl Levitt, was already inside. Hours later, at 8 a.m., a friend called to finalize their plans for the day, but no one answered. When she went to the house, their cars were all in the driveway and their purses and belongings were inside, but Cheryl, Susie, and Stacy were gone. Detectives quickly determined that they had been abducted. An exhaustive investigation followed with nonstop media attention, but despite this, no sign of the women was ever found. 33 years later, Cheryl Levitt, Susie Streeter, and Stacy McCall are still missing, and the question remains, what happened to the Springfield Three? Hey everyone, welcome back to Detective Perspective. My name is Derek Levasseur. I'm a licensed private investigator and former police detective. Each week I'll be covering an unsolved case in story format. I'll then give you my perspective on the investigation and provide contact information for the individuals or organizations connected to the case so that if you have any tips, you can contact them directly and maybe you can help solve a case. So if you're someone who's interested in true crime, specifically unsolved cases, and you would like to hear my opinion on those investigations, please consider subscribing, whether you're watching on YouTube or listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use. Okay, we're doing it. The Springfield Three. This is a huge mystery, one of the bigger cases that we've covered on this channel. And some of you have reached out to me and asked if I would give my opinion on it. The truth is, I covered this case with Stephanie on Crime Weekly in 2022. We did a 3 or 4 part series on this case. We did a really big deep dive on all the facts of the case, and I strongly recommend you go check that out if you haven't done so already. But I wanted to cover it here for multiple reasons. One, I feel like people who are specifically looking for unsolved cases and calls to action, this is where they're coming. And I want to make sure that I'm hitting every member of my audience, whether you're listening to me on Crime Weekly or over here. I want there to be carryover for both. I don't mind the cross-pollination. I'd rather you hear or see something twice than not see it at all. Although if you've been following me for a while, then you know that the way I cover cases here is different than the way we cover cases on Crime Weekly. So you're still going to get a lot of value out of this. And I also want to mention that when I decided to cover this case, I initially thought that I was going to go back and watch the series that we already did to see what my final opinions were. And then I changed my mind. I decided that I wanted to come at this with a fresh perspective because it's been long enough where I remember some of the major bullet points, but I don't remember all the details, all the players in the game. And instead of filling my brain with what I previously thought, I said, you know what? I'm going to reread everything again, come at it with a fresh perspective, and see if my final thoughts are the same as they were on Crime Weekly 3 years ago. So one thing that I'm going to do after this episode comes out is go back and watch Crime Weekly and see if my opinions have changed. I don't think my opinion will completely change, but I'm hoping that by looking at everything again, maybe I offer a new piece of information or a new idea that I didn't mention when I initially covered it. And that's what I'm always recommending in all of these other cases that we talk about from a law enforcement perspective. Even though you may have already looked at something, even though you may think that you've turned over all the rocks possible, it never hurts to go back and start from the beginning again and reread or re-listen to everything you have, because taking a second look at it may allow you to catch something that you missed the first time. And that little piece, that little nugget that you caught on that second attempt, that may be the thing that cracks the case wide open. You never know. And so I'm trying to practice what I preach here by doing the same. So we do have a lot to cover. This is a big case. I'm going to keep it directed on all the facts of the case. We're not going to go into a lot of the speculation, but I don't want to waste any more time. Let's dive into this week's case. In the spring of 1992, two close friends, 18-year-old Stacy McCall and 19-year-old Susie Streeter, were finishing up their senior year at Kickapoo High School in Springfield, Missouri. Both young women were excited for graduation and everything that came after it. Stacy, often described as warm, upbeat, and full of energy, was the youngest of three daughters in a close family. She balanced school with two jobs, working as a secretary at the Springfield Gymnastics Center and modeling wedding gowns for a family friend's business. After high school, she planned to attend Southwest Missouri State University and join a sorority with her best friend. Susie, known for her outgoing and fun personality, was the younger of two siblings. She lived with her mother, Cheryl Levitt, after her parents divorced, and the two shared a strong bond. Cheryl, described as focused, meticulous, and fiercely protective, had built a career as a hairdresser and regularly saw around 250 clients. By 1992, Susie and Cheryl were living together in a home that Cheryl had recently purchased and was renovating, and it was located at 1717 East Delmar Street. Susie loved doing hair as much as her mother did, and she planned to attend cosmetology school after graduation. In the meantime, she worked at a local movie theater. Susie, Cheryl, and Stacy all had big plans for the future, but tragically, they would never get the chance to fulfill them. On June 6, 1992, Susie and Stacy graduated from high school. That evening, the plan was for them to meet at their friend Janelle's home, attend two parties, and then head to Branson. They would stay overnight and go to the Whitewater theme park the next day. At around 8 p.m., Susie arrived at Janelle's house in the suburb of Battlefield. The Springfield News Leader reported that Stacy arrived soon after, and the girls walked next door to the first party. At around 10:30 p.m., Stacy called home to let her mom Janice know that their plans had changed. They decided to wait until the morning to drive to Branson, so they were now staying at Janelle's for the night, and she promised to call again before they left in the morning. Shortly after the call, the group went to the second party, and this one was located in Springfield in the 1500 block of East Hanover Street. Now, it's important to note that at around that same time, Cheryl, who was still at home, spoke with a friend about a piece of furniture that she was refinishing. And why that's so important is because this call was the last time anyone heard from Cheryl. So back to Stacy, Susie, and Janelle. They left this second party at around 1:40 a.m. and they returned to Janelle's house, but when they got there, they realized that Janelle's family had visiting relatives that were sleeping in her room. So at that point, Stacy and Susie decided they were going to go back to Susie's home instead. And if we're to believe everything that we know so far, they reached Delmar Street at around 2:15 a.m. So that's our window. They get back to Cheryl Levitt's house at approximately 2:15 in the morning. So fast forward to 8 a.m., Janelle calls Susie's house to confirm the plans for Branson, and no one answers the phone, so she leaves a message. By 12:30 p.m., when Stacy and Susie still hadn't reached out, Janelle and her boyfriend Mike drove over to check on them, and according to the Springfield News Leader, all three women's cars were still parked outside the house. When Janelle and Mike reached the front porch of the house, they had noticed some broken glass and quickly realized that the glass was from a globe that had been on the front porch light, which had shattered. And it is important to note that even though the globe was shattered, the bulb was still working. And at that time, they had just assumed that maybe the globe had been bumped accidentally during the night. And because they assumed it was just an accident, Mike grabbed a broom, swept up the glass, and tossed it into the garage, believing that he was actually helping Cheryl, unaware he might actually be disturbing evidence. So while Mike is cleaning up this glass, Janelle starts looking through all the windows and she sees no one inside, and she's starting to get a sense that something's off. So she cracks open the front door, which, by the way, was unlocked. No sign of forced entry. And when she starts to partially open the door, that's when Susie's Yorkie, Cinnamon, rushes towards them and is barking nonstop, which was very unusual for Cinnamon. So at that point, Mike and Janelle step inside, and the house was quiet. Nothing appeared to be out of place. It looked like the women had gone through their nighttime routines, and in both Cheryl's and Susie's rooms, the beds looked like they had been slept in. In addition to that, there were also these damp washcloths that were left out, suggesting makeup had been removed before bed, and their jewelry was actually sitting on the sink. And according to the Springfield News Leader, Susie's TV was also on, but only static filled the screen. Her bed was unmade, and two blinds had been separated as if someone had looked outside. The rest of her room was slightly messy, pretty typical for a teenager. Additionally, Stacy's belongings were at the foot of the bed. She had folded her flowered shorts, tucked her jewelry in her pockets, and placed everything neatly on top of her sandals. Her migraine medication, something she always kept with her, was still there as well. In front of Susie's bedroom, all three women's purses were on the floor together. Nothing appeared missing. All their car keys were there, and Cheryl's purse still had $900 in cash inside. What's also worth noting is that both Susie and Cheryl's cigarettes were there too, which stood out to family and friends since both women smoked heavily. Now here's where it gets a little weird, because while Janelle and Mike were inside, the phone rang, and Janelle answered, and when she did, a man immediately began making sexual comments, so understandably she hung up. Moments later, the phone rang again, and this time it was the same voice and they made the same explicit remarks. According to the Springfield News Leader, at that point, Janelle and Mike left the residence and proceeded to check places the women might have gone, a friend's house and a nearby restaurant, but obviously they didn't find them. So they eventually reached out to Stacy's mom, Janice, who said that she had also been trying to reach them for hours, but she couldn't get in touch with them. So after learning this information from Janelle and Mike, Janice decided to go to the house herself and look around. And when she got there, she noticed that the answering machine's message light was blinking. So, trying to find out what was going on, she played the message, which she later remembered only as quote-unquote strange. The machine, unfortunately, automatically erased it after playback, and I went around to try to find this message again or find out more information about it, and this was a point that I had brought up when we had covered on Crime Weekly, and unfortunately, even now, 2025, we don't know what was said on that message. I've seen some rumors, but all I can find is that Janice claimed that it was strange. I don't know if it was similar to what Janelle had received hours earlier. That would be my best guess. But overall, I would really love to know what was said, because when we consider why we're here, it could be critical to the case. Yeah, it could be a nothing burger, but I would like to make that judgment for myself. And speaking of the phone, as more friends and family arrived, it rang again. Someone answered, and once more, a stranger made sexually explicit comments. Another similar call came in later, and this time they let the machine answer, and I thought, okay, that's a really good move. But again, it was this lewd message, and the people there at the time believed it was just some cruel postgraduate prank, so someone erased it. Thought we had something. Nope. They got rid of it. Unfortunate. Really unfortunate, because there's not a lot to go off of in this case. So after those calls came in, True Crime Daily reported that the group decided to wait at the home, expecting the women to return. And to pass the time, they cleaned up. They emptied ashtrays. They rinsed coffee cups. They even adjusted a bent window blind, unintentionally disturbing potential evidence. And it breaks my heart to even say that, because that's where everything went down. That's the center point. That's ground zero. And although it was 1992, if they just removed themselves from that home and waited for investigators to arrive, maybe something would have been collected that wouldn't have been contaminated. They could still go through elimination processes to rule out anybody who was there, but going in there and destroying your evidence by cleaning things, by bending window blinds back, at that point, you're really in a bad position. As an investigator, as a crime scene forensics analyst, you're in a tough spot, because you can't recreate what that scene looked like before they decided to clean it up. So unintentional, definitely an accident. And I'm sure to this day, the people who were there probably regret doing what they did. And that's a burden they have to carry. It's unfortunate, but that's just how it goes sometimes. When hours passed with no sign of Cheryl, Susie, or Stacy, Janice finally called the police. Officers came to the house and looked around, but with everything already cleaned up, there wasn't much to see. They filed a missing persons report and left a note on the door politely asking the women to call and cancel the report if they returned. But that was it. And obviously, that's not right. That's the wrong way to do this. This is clearly an issue. These three women, who were fully capable of taking care of themselves, vanished without a trace. They had plans. They didn't call anybody back. They weren't returning anybody's calls. All their property was still at that residence. I don't know what else you need to know that there's something wrong here, and there needs to be an investigation immediately, because time is of the essence. But that's not what they did. And we have a lot more to cover right after this break. Don't go anywhere. We're going to talk about potential suspects, a possible suspect vehicle, theories on what could have happened. There's a lot more to go. We're just getting into it. We'll be right back. The holiday season is officially here, which means we're going to be very busy in the best way possible. And hopefully you're going to be having many get-togethers at your house, which means you're going to need a good cleaning. And that's where HomeAglow, the game-changing cleaning service, comes into play. This episode is sponsored by HomeAglow, a top-rated home service platform dedicated to making your space clean and tidy, and it's super easy to use. They have online booking capabilities that allow you to instantly schedule a cleaner in your area for a special occasion, party, or regularly to help take something off your plate. You can get access to trusted cleaners in your area, and you can actually see their reviews and profiles before you book them. Cleaners have to pass a rigorous certification process and must maintain a 4.8 star average platform rating. And the best part, 100% of the cleaning fees and tips go directly to the cleaner. So you're supporting real people in your community, not some giant corporation. So here's how it works. To schedule a cleaning, you simply go to HomeAglow's website to choose the day and time you're looking for and the duration of your cleaning, and they'll match you with a cleaner. Then you can schedule as quickly as within that week or get something on the calendar for next month to check it off your to-do list. And if you really want to make your life easier, you have to check out their Forever Clean membership, which saves you $30 an hour on all future cleanings. You can book unlimited cleaning starting at just $19 an hour, and it's backed by HomeAglow's happiness guarantee. So take cleaning off your plate this holiday season by using HomeAglow. Head to homeaglow.com/detective to get your first 3 hours of cleaning for only $19. That's HomeAglow.com/detective. All right, we're back. And when the woman hadn't returned by the morning of June 8th, it was at that point when it became clear to investigators that they hadn't left voluntarily. So detectives got involved, and they believe that they were likely abducted between 2:15 a.m. when Stacy and Susie got home and 8 a.m. when Janelle first tried to call them. While it seemed clear an abduction had taken place, it was unclear how three women could disappear from a home without any signs of a struggle. And some family members believe this was because more than one perpetrator was involved. But detectives felt like it could have been the work of one person. One theory they repeatedly considered is that someone used a ruse, like posing as a utility worker and warning of a gas leak just to get the women out of their house. And I completely agree with this. You could have posed as a utility worker, as a police officer, as a concerned neighbor, anything just to wake them up and say, oh my God, your house is on fire, or there's something going on over here, we need your help, anything. And at that point, if they're half asleep, it's very possible they believed what the person was saying and they walked outside their house. And this brings me back to the unlocked door. I don't know what the common practice was for Cheryl. I know most people today, especially I know myself, I always lock the door before I go to bed. I'm going to assume that was the case for them. And if Cheryl was already asleep, I would like to think that Susie or Stacy would have locked the door. And if that is true, and we found the door unlocked, that means someone did it from the inside, which would lean into the theory that they voluntarily unlocked the door, which would give more credence to the theory that at the time, someone was on the other side of that door that they didn't see as a threat. And the Springfield police realized that they couldn't handle this case alone, so multiple agencies, including the FBI, were brought in to help. And while teams searched the surrounding areas, detectives processed the home. According to the Springfield News Leader, they found no helpful evidence, no blood, no hair, no fingerprints, no DNA. That could be because things were cleaned up. I would like to think that even with them being in there rummaging around, they would have found some type of forensic evidence, even if it just came back to the people who were there, but we don't know the specifics. Either way, as I said earlier, when you have people in there using cleaning agents, fixing potential damage of blinds, that's going to hinder and impede the investigation exponentially. I do want to mention that in Susie's rooms, detectives found a few things that stood out, including items referencing satanic themes. They looked further into this and learned that Susie had recently dated a guy named Dusty, who was part of a grave robbing group with two other guys named Michael and Joseph. Now, from what we know, when Susie found out about the grave robbing, she ended the relationship, which is good to hear. And she didn't just end the relationship. Not long before her disappearance, Susie reported the group's activities to police. Dusty and the others were arrested and charged with grave robbing. After learning this, detectives questioned whether Dusty or his friends could have retaliated against Susie, so all three men were brought in for interviews. They denied any involvement in the disappearances, and they also passed polygraph tests, and they were ruled out at that time, though many people believe that decision was made prematurely. And I don't know all the specifics. I don't know if they had an alibi. Even with them coming in and denying any involvement and passing the polygraphs, we know that the polygraphs are more of a tool and not a deciding factor. So if that's the sole reason that they were ruled out, I completely disagree. Now, if they provided an alibi that was cross-referenced and confirmed, maybe it's the right call. But I didn't see anything in my research that indicated they knew definitively that it was physically impossible for even one of the three individuals to have been in the town at that time when the disappearances occurred. And if that's true, then I agree with the majority of the people out there who believe they shouldn't have been ruled out, because it's a pretty strong motive when you think about it, right? Not only did she end things with Dusty, which I'm sure he didn't like, but then she goes out there and she rats him out. She snitches on him and they end up getting charged with that. And maybe they're thinking, hey, if she's not around, maybe these charges get dropped. I don't know how far they were in the judicial process. I can't imagine they were very far. So you get rid of the key witness and maybe you get off for the crime. Pretty solid motive when you don't have a lot to go off of. But listen, unfortunately, Dusty wasn't the only problematic relationship in Susie's past. Before Dusty, she dated a man named Mike Kovacs. In October of 1991, Susie obtained a restraining order alleging he had assaulted her, slashed her tire, threatened her by phone, and repeatedly harassed her. Susie and Cheryl also filed a police report stating that Mike and another woman had threatened Susie and damaged her car twice. A hearing was set for November, but Susie didn't show and the protection order was dismissed. So now here's another person that may have an axe to grind with Susie, and as soon as detectives were made aware of this, they went to speak with Mike about the disappearances, and he was able to provide an alibi for the night the women vanished, and he was ruled out, which, if the alibi's solid, I have no problems with it. But as we will learn in this episode, just because someone gives you an alibi that is corroborated by someone else, if that person that's confirming the alibi has a relationship with that person, you have to put a weight on it, right? If it's not on camera, if it's not on video, and it's someone close to them, a family member, a friend, someone they're in a relationship with, maybe don't rule them out completely. Yes, I'm foreshadowing here. And while we're talking about previous relationships, I also want to mention that Cheryl's ex-husband and his son Bart were also ruled out as well. So I mainly focused on Cheryl and Susie because I'm just going to put it out there right now. Whoever went to this house, whoever was involved in this crime, more than likely went there for Susie and or Cheryl. I think that Stacy was just collateral damage. I don't know if they expected her to be there, although I will say that in the perspective, I'm going to mention a theory where Cheryl was actually the collateral damage, but that theory is low on my list. So detectives kept interviewing witnesses and retracing the women's final hours, but nothing they had looked into gave them any indication as to what happened to them. Tips continued coming in, and according to the Springfield News Leader, tipsters reported seeing a man with long hair and a beard near the Levitt home on June 6th and 7th. Police released a sketch of this man, but as far as I can tell, he was never identified. And if you're watching on YouTube, that sketch is up on the screen right now, and it's a pretty good sketch, if it's accurate. It could be someone from the area. It might be someone who was just passing through. It's always a little concerning when the person doesn't come forward who's in the sketch, but I've seen it happen before, not necessarily a sketch, but someone who's in a video or a photo that we put out and it's on all the news networks. And then 4 months later, a patrolman stops this person after identifying them. And when we bring them in, they had nothing to do with the crime and they literally had no clue that we were looking for them. Genuinely. Like they're like, oh wait, yeah, that's me. Wow, that's funny. You got my photo from that day. And I'm like, dude, I've been looking for you for months, but it does happen. However, yeah, when you have someone like this who was seen in that area around the time of the disappearance and they haven't come forward, sure, it's going to raise an eyebrow. Other witnesses reported seeing a 1964 to 1970 Dodge panel van, and the color was a moss green with a white front grille, and it was in the area around the time of the disappearances. One woman told the police that she was sitting on her porch on the morning of June 7th when she saw this moss green Dodge van pull up into her neighbor's driveway. And at the time, a young blonde woman who looked like Susie was in the driver's seat and appeared to be frightened. And according to this witness, she heard a man say, quote, "Don't do anything stupid." It's a lot, right? That's a lot to take in right there, because you have the van in the area around the time of the disappearances. You have a woman in the front seat driving the van who appears to look like Susie. And now, if you're to believe all of it, this witness also heard a man coming, I'm assuming, from the back of the van saying, "Don't do anything stupid." So if this is all true, if we're to believe everything she just said, more than likely this is somehow connected to the crime, right? We have a woman who looks like one of our victims and seems like she's afraid, and she's being told by a man we can't see, "Don't do anything stupid." Yeah, I think it'd be connected to the case. The question is everything accurate that's being reported? Was it on the day of the disappearances? Is that exactly what she heard? Did the woman actually look like Susie? This would be the time where I'd like to see a report where a photo lineup was made, brought to this witness, and she positively identified Susie as the woman she saw driving the van. Maybe that happened. If it did, I haven't seen the report. However, I will say that this witness wasn't the only one that reported something about a van, because according to the Springfield News Leader, a man also reported seeing a blonde woman in a van outside the grocery store near the Levitt home on the same morning of the disappearances. Now, he did the right thing and he wrote down the license plate, but he threw it out. He threw it out later because he felt like it wasn't needed or wasn't relevant. Why not bring that to police? Why not hold on to it? Man, if we could go back. If he got the right plate, at minimum, we would be able to track down the van and track down the blonde woman. Now, we got nothing. But good start. In the future, especially now with technology, guys, if you have a gut feeling about something and you write a license plate down or you take a photo of it, don't delete it. It's taking up little to no space on your phone. Keep it there for a year or two, maybe three if you can, if you don't mind. You never know. There could be a podcast like this that's saying, hey, if you saw a green van in that area at that time, help us out. That information would be pretty helpful right about now, right? Think about that next time you're about to delete something. I want you to see my face or hear my voice and go, yeah, Derek told me not to. I'm going to keep it. I'd appreciate it. All right, so back to this van. You now have two independent witnesses reporting something suspicious about it, and they both gave a similar description of not only the van, but also the driver. So at that point, police released a photo of a van that would look similar to the one they described. But again, as far as I can tell to this day, 2025, nothing came of it, unfortunately. So here's what I will say about the van, because a lot of people have talked about it. A lot of people have speculated about its potential involvement in the Springfield 3. And here's what I've deduced. The van's a real thing. The blonde woman driving the van, also a real thing. Two independent people both reported it on the morning of the disappearance. So I think it's legit. I think it's a real thing. And there may have been something going on with that van. The question is it connected to the Springfield 3? And without a better description, without an identification of that van and of that driver, we may never know. If I'm a betting man, for me personally, I think there's too many coincidences for it not to be related. It's in the same area, around the same time, with a driver who looks like one of our victims. And you add in the wrinkle of this guy saying, don't do anything stupid, and there may be something there. Does that help us now, sitting here 30 plus years later? Maybe. We're going to talk about that more at the end. As time passed, fewer tips came in and less information was shared publicly. By 1997, 5 years after the woman vanished, the Springfield Police Department announced they could no longer dedicate active manpower to the case beyond reviewing viable incoming leads. In 2001, a new commander took over the detective division and launched a fresh review of cold cases, starting with the Springfield 3. Detectives created a list of 10 individuals who could not be ruled out. Reported names included Robert Craig Cox, Larry DeWayne Hall, Steve Garrison, and Gerald Carnahan. One of the most publicized was Robert Craig Cox, a convicted kidnapper and robber. In 1992, he was questioned about the Springfield 3 and gave an alibi for June 6th and 7th, one his girlfriend supported. So because of that, he was ruled out at the time. Remember that, we talked about it earlier. A few years later, he was arrested for unrelated crimes, and his girlfriend recanted her statement confirming his alibi. When detectives spoke with Cox again, he acted as if he had inside information, claiming he knew the women had been murdered and buried and that their bodies would never be found. Despite this new revelation, detectives were never able to obtain verifiable details from him, and he has never been officially named as a suspect in the Springfield 3 case. Now, let's move on to Larry DeWayne Hall, a suspected serial killer who traveled the Midwest for Civil War reenactments and was another name that had surfaced during the investigation. Hall was known to target victims near those events, and he participated in a reenactment about 30 minutes from Springfield on June 6, 1992. According to the Unresolved podcast, Hall was questioned at one point in the murder of Shauna Garber, a case BTK was also questioned in. At the time he was questioned, Hall denied any involvement in her murder, but he said he did kill the Springfield 3 and many others. The details of his confession aren't known, only that he said, quote, The Springfield Three, we killed them. It's unclear who the "we" was referring to. Detectives reviewed Hall's various confessions and were able to disprove some of them, so clearly he was taking credit for cases he had nothing to do with. I will say it's unclear whether the Springfield 3 case was one they were able to rule out, and at this point, he has never been officially named as a suspect in the case. We have more suspects to talk about, including one suspect who gave information to law enforcement that had never been released publicly. We're going to talk about it right after the break. As a busy parent with multiple jobs, it's been such a game changer to do my weekly food shopping with Hungry Root. Hungry Root plans all of my meals for the week, it shops for me, and it even delivers groceries that fit my health goals, diet preferences, and budget. Hungry Root will help you eat well and reach your diet or health goals, whether that's gluten-free, dairy-free, high protein, focused on gut health, or anything else. All you have to do is take a quick quiz, and their smart cart technology recommends groceries and recipes tailored to your tastes and needs. Unlike other food delivery companies, Hungry Root now has over 50,000 chef-crafted recipes to choose from every week, with many ready in under 15 minutes or less. And with over 1,000 grocery items like smoothies, sweets, kid snacks, salad kits, ready-to-eat meals, and supplements, it's easy to find options that fit everyone's tastes and needs in your family. I love Hungry Root. I've been using them for a while now. I've talked about many of the meals that I've made and how delicious they were. I just again had one of my go-tos, which was their grass-fed ribeye steak. I had the microwave sweet potato, which I absolutely love. And then for a snack earlier today, I had their buffalo chicken jerky stick and one of my favorites, the sun butter and jam dippers. I actually have the package right over there. The only complaint: there's not enough. And I know it's portion control, but I'm just saying a few more wouldn't hurt. And Hungry Root holds all of its food to high standards, screening out over 200 additives, including high fructose corn syrup, artificial sweeteners, and preservatives. They source only high quality meat and seafood with no hormones or antibiotics, offer organic produce and non-GMO options, and carry trusted healthy brands like Oatly, Vital Farms, Ithaca Hummus, Harmless Harvest, and many more. So take advantage of this exclusive offer. For a limited time, you can get 40% off your first box, plus get a free item in every box for life. All you have to do is go to hungryroot.com/detective and use my code detective. That's hungryroot.com/detective, code detective, to get 40% off your first box and a free item of your choice for life. Whether it's holiday plans, a reality TV show, or just a cold morning, I need my wardrobe to just work. And that's why I'm all about this next sponsor, Quince. They make it easy to look sharp, feel good, and find gifts that last. From Mongolian cashmere sweaters to Italian wool coats, Quince pieces are crafted from premium materials and built to hold up without the luxury markup. Quince makes the essentials that every guy needs. The Mongolian cashmere sweaters, you've seen the prices online, some of the places out there. $50 on Quince. You cannot beat that. And their outerwear lineup is no joke as well. I actually have one of their jackets right here, wore it into work today. It's freezing out. This is awesome. Just got this in the mail. They also have down jackets, wool top coats, and leather styles that are built to last a lifetime. Each piece is made with premium materials by trusted factories that meet rigorous standards for craftsmanship and ethical production. And by cutting out the middleman and traditional markups, Quince delivers the same quality as luxury brands at a fraction of the price. It's everything you actually want to wear, but built to hold up season after season. And I have to tell you, Quince is kind of my secret weapon. I mentioned reality shows. There was a jacket that I wore on Traders. It was like this black quilted jacket with the corduroy collar. It's probably still one of my favorite jackets. Everyone was asking me about it. Got it from Quince. Absolutely love it. It's a daily driver. This cashmere sweater that I'm wearing right now, also from Quince. And that's what I love about their products, right? It looks super high end because it is, but you're not paying those extremely ridiculous costs that you see everywhere else. So it allows you to dress up, dress nice without breaking the bank. And listen, I know I'm directing this at the guys right now, but that's only because I've worn so many of their clothes so I can personally endorse it. But they also have some amazing clothes for women as well. They also have bags and accessories, so they're fully loaded. They have something for everyone. So get your wardrobe sorted and your gift list handled with Quince. Don't wait. Go to quince.com/detective for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada as well. That's quince.com/detective. One more time. That's quince.com/detective. Free shipping and 365-day returns. You can't beat it. Check it out. quince.com/detective. All right, we're back. Let's talk about some more suspects. I'm going to start with Stephen Garrison. Now, he was involved in the Galloping Goose Motorcycle Club and was another name on that list that I had mentioned earlier. In 1993, he told police he knew what happened to the Springfield 3 and offered information in exchange for help on an unrelated weapons charge. When investigators agreed, he claimed he overheard a friend confessing to the murders at a party and said the women's bodies were taken to a hog farm. Detectives haven't provided more details on Garrison's confession. However, they have said he provided details that weren't public. So he had some information about this case that, as far as detectives were concerned, nobody outside the investigation knew about, which would be considered guilt knowledge. And that's always going to give a little bit more credibility to the witness. However, it is possible that they just got lucky and they threw out some shit, and one of the things they said was accurate. But again, it could have been just luck. And I tend to believe that might have been the case because the information did seem promising at first, and a judge lowered his bail and the police moved him to a hotel where he immediately fled, right? So he gets the deal after saying he's going to provide this information. And as soon as he gets a chance to actually help police out, he takes off. And it gets even worse because days later, he attacked a woman in Springfield and was convicted of rape, sodomy, burglary, and robbery. And he has never been charged with anything else in relation to the Springfield 3 case. As far as I can tell, he remains on the list of potential suspects because of the accuracy of some of his details, but that's about it. So for me, as I'm sitting here right now, it's one of two things. He did have guilt knowledge, but he was never planning on ratting out his friend. Or, like I had said, he got lucky and he was only doing that because he knew he wanted to get out just to hurt this woman. I don't know if he knew her or not, but he was a bad guy and he just wanted to continue doing what he was doing. So it's very possible that he used the system to do what he wanted to do. And he really doesn't know anything about this case. However, without being able to clear him definitively, he's got to be on the list. The last suspect I want to talk about is Gerald Carnahan, who had a long history of violence toward women. In the 1980s, he was linked to the murders of Jackie Johns and Debbie Sue Lewis in Springfield, though he wasn't charged at the time. Less than a year after the Springfield 3 disappeared, he was arrested for attempting to kidnap another woman. Because of this pattern of behavior, investigators looked at him closely but found no solid evidence connecting him to the Springfield 3. Years later, DNA linked him to Jackie's murder and he received a life sentence, so he's not going anywhere, but he was never charged in Debbie's case and he has never been named an official suspect in the Springfield 3 case. So despite multiple persons of interest and/or suspects, years continued to pass with little movement in the investigation. By 2015, the police had compiled more than 27,000 pages of documentation and logged over 5,200 tips. They conducted countless polygraphs, searched large wooded areas, and chased leads through 21 states, all without finding a single trace of the women. So, not good. And it's not for lack of exposure or engagement from the community. Just nothing yet to get us to where we need to be to find these three women and bring them home. Fast forward to 2025, 33 years have passed since their disappearances. And in June, the Springfield Police Department told KY3 that despite an exhaustive investigation, no promising leads have emerged to explain why the women vanished or where they might be. They also said they aren't receiving as many tips anymore and need the public to come forward with anything they know. Unfortunately, that is the last update we have in this case. Cheryl Levitt, Susie Streeter, and Stacy McCall are still missing, leaving their loved ones and the community wondering what happened in the early morning hours of June 7th, 1992. All right, let's dive into this perspective, and I want to elaborate on some of the things that I laid out in the episode. We'll first start with persons of interest slash suspects. It's a long list of just the people we know. There's a few individuals who had an axe to grind with Cheryl or Susie. They could have been retaliating. There were also individuals in that area who had no direct connection but had a pattern of behavior that would align with carrying out a crime like this. And then you also have to consider the complete stranger, the person who has no previous connection to Cheryl, Susie, or Stacy, and yet saw them at one point in time and decided that on June 7th, that was going to be the night that they decided to attack. And when you consider that, you have to think about the possible scenarios. And you could be looking at a few different options here that all work equally just as well. To me, the most prominent theory is, like I had laid out earlier in the episode, that someone approached that door in the middle of the night. Maybe the door was already locked. Maybe it was unlocked. If it was unlocked, then there would be no need to wake anybody up to carry out this ruse. You could walk inside, get the drop on the women, and then that's it. It's game over for them. Or they could have been at the door pretending to be a friendly, a neighbor, a police officer, a utility worker, a construction worker. You knock on the door, someone approaches, you make it seem like there's an emergency. They unlock the door, and at that point, it's game over. Why is it game over? Why is there no sign of a struggle inside? I think it's a simple explanation. Whether it's one person or 15 people involved, all they need is a gun or a knife. That instant shock value that it has for someone who's not exposed to that on a daily basis, you're going to instantly be able to gain control of your victim and or victims. So this person, however they gained access, gets inside with a gun or knife. And at that point, Cheryl, Susie, and Stacy are all told, you're going to be okay. You're going to be safe. If one of you tries to flee, we're going to kill the others. So you can't go anywhere. If you try to go anywhere, we're going to catch you. We're going to hurt you and or kill you, but we're also going to kill your friends and family. You're not going to try to escape. You're not going to leave the other two behind and risk them being hurt or killed. Also, this is under the assumption that there's only one suspect. If there's more than one suspect, then now they have you surrounded and there's nowhere for you to go. So regardless of how many people were involved, I believe wholeheartedly that's what happened. This person entered the home with a weapon, and that's how they were able to gain control so easily and more than likely ordered the women to get out of their beds, go out to the vehicle, and leave the area without screaming for help or making any type of commotion that would alert the fellow neighbors in the area. But now let's reverse engineer it from there. How did we get to the point where the suspect or suspects are at this door making entry, however they got inside? Why did they identify this house as the place that they wanted to attack? Is it because they previously knew someone who lived there, Cheryl or Susie? That's one explanation. In that case, then Stacy was collateral damage. I would also lean toward the door being unlocked and this person knowing about that prior to going there, because if Stacy or Susie knew the person at the door, and this was someone who is not a friendly, more than likely they wouldn't have opened it. Unless there are multiple parties involved and the person who was retaliating against them sent a friend to the door who they didn't already know. That's also a possibility. So yes, that's one scenario. Another scenario is that Susie and Stacy are out at these parties. Was there someone at one of these parties who identified these women as someone they wanted to take advantage of? Maybe it was the first party. Maybe it was the second party. Maybe Stacy and Susie stopped somewhere on the ride home. Or maybe while they were in their car, someone drove past them and saw them and said, hey, I'm going to follow them. That's kind of more unlikely than some of the other scenarios, but we can't completely rule it out. And in that case, this person would have followed them home, waited outside the residence. Once the lights go off, that's when this person decides to attack. And that could be why the globe was broken. I know they say it was accidental and that the light was still working. I question whether the light was on. Was it working because they tested it and were able to confirm that the bulb itself was still intact? Possible. But I would like to know more because it's still a possibility that this suspect or one of the suspects broke the light thinking they had got it all. And then in a haste, they didn't get the bulb. But, you know, they're dumbasses. They didn't go all the way with it. I still think that's possible. And maybe the bulb just kind of went out when they hit it. And then when, you know, investigators or whoever played with it a little bit and turned it on, it still worked. Somehow this globe is connected to it. I don't think that Cheryl would have left the broken glass out on the front porch. It would have hurt someone. Someone could have stepped on it and hurt themselves. So that broken glass is absolutely connected to this crime. Another scenario that I want to throw out about the glass before I lose sight of it and I forget to mention it. This is really tough to envision, but if you think that these women were tied up and carried outside the residence, you could be looking at a scenario where one of them hit their head or their feet on the globe as they were being carried out of the residence to the vehicle. You'd like to think that's not what happened, but I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't mention it. Something happened with that globe that is absolutely directly connected to this crime. What it is, I don't completely know, but those are two very plausible scenarios. I also want to mention quickly a theory regarding Cheryl and her furniture, because I have seen some rumblings that she may have potentially been selling her furniture. That's why she was refinishing it. So you could have a scenario where someone went to the address under the pretense of a potential buyer, but in reality, they were just there casing the joint. And when they saw that Cheryl lived alone with, maybe they realized her daughter, they saw that as a good spot to hit at a later date. And that's what happened. But even if that's not the way this person came in contact with Cheryl, I still think the whole neighbor stranger scenario is still very possible. You could have someone who walked that neighborhood, ran through that neighborhood, drove through that neighborhood on their way to work, and over time realized who lived at that residence. And they had this itch to scratch that they've been thinking about for years, and they had been building up to this. We just covered BTK on Crime Weekly. It's a similar set of circumstances where you have a monster amongst you and you don't even know it, and they're just looking for a victim of opportunity. And unfortunately, they decided to choose Cheryl's home, which is something similar we saw with the Oteros in the BTK case. That was his first murder, as far as we know, and he had really no previous connection to that family. So we can't rule that out either. Where does that leave me as far as sitting here right now, 33 years later? I think it's a hybrid, right? I personally believe this was a planned attack. Was it someone she previously knew? If you made me choose, I would say yes. I think this person was aware of the dynamics in that area, that neighborhood. Not only that neighborhood, but also Cheryl's home. I think this person knew that Cheryl lived there with just Susie, two women, alone. They more than likely knew that they didn't have a weapon. And they more than likely knew their pattern of behavior, that they would leave their door unlocked, where they slept, that they had a dog, how they could get into the house and get out without being detected. What their motive was, I can't tell you. It doesn't necessarily have to be retaliatory. It could be just someone who knew them over the years and always had this thought, but never acted upon it. And finally, they decided to do so. And if that's the case, whether they were a friend or a foe, that would mean that Stacy, unfortunately, was at the wrong place at the wrong time. And that's just terrible to think that one different decision may have resulted in a different outcome, where it's still a horrible situation, but you may only be talking about Cheryl and not Susie and Stacy as well, who had their whole lives ahead of them. They were just getting started. And whenever you have young people involved, it makes the case that much worse. But that's the morbid side of it. That's where we are. That's the things we can't change. What can we do in an investigation that you would probably assume everything has already been done? You got multiple police agencies, the FBI, 5,200 tips, 27,000 documents. What are you going to do at home? Maybe it's the van. That's what I'm leaning toward. I don't understand for the life of me how I'm sitting here right now in 2026 and this van hasn't been identified. I'm sure that registration DMV records weren't as good as they are now, and they probably weren't even completely digitized, but the list can't be that long. And if it is, I apologize. Maybe someone's going to tell me that van in that color with that white grill was very common in the Missouri area. If there's thousands of them, then I'll stand corrected and I'll apologize next week. But I would bet that when we're talking about that particular van for that year range and that color with that white grill, there's not as many of as you think. So you go through, you identify as many as you can, you look up the registered owners, and you check their criminal history before the disappearances and all the way up till now. Because even if they hadn't committed a crime before the Springfield 3, maybe they committed one after. Maybe they're currently serving time for a crime similar to the Springfield 3. This sounds like common sense, but I have to throw it out there because maybe it hasn't been done yet. And maybe somebody involved with the case will go, hey, you know what? I'm going to take a look at that. But we can't just rely on law enforcement. I'm also talking to you guys. If you are from that area and you know someone who back during that time frame was driving around in a vehicle similar to that, call the police. Let them know. Even if you feel like you know the person who owned it. If you can't account for them on the night of June 6th, June 7th, give a call. Let them know that, hey, listen, I lived in that area, or my uncle lived in that area, or my cousin lived in that area, and they drive a very similar vehicle. And I don't know, maybe go talk to them. You know, they were involved in something a few years later that was with a woman. And, you know, I don't think they're that bad of a person, but it's worth visiting. You may look at it and say, there's no shot that it's so-and-so. Let law enforcement decide. Let them go down that journey and see what they come up with. Don't be detective at home. Let us decide whether it's valuable or not. That's what I would say as I'm sitting here right now. That's really all we have is that van and the blonde woman potentially driving it. We also need that witness, if she's still around, to positively identify that blonde woman who is driving that van as Susie Streeter, if she's able to do so. That's something that should have been done at the beginning of this investigation. But that's where I stand on it. It's a group effort. It's going to be law enforcement continuing to go over the information they already have to see if there's something they missed. And also the community continuing to talk about this case as if it happened yesterday, because the memories are still there. There could be someone right now listening or watching who says, you know what? I remember a green van like that. Maybe it wasn't a relative. Maybe it was a neighbor. And maybe you always had a suspicion about them. And for some reason, you never put two and two together until now. And if that's you, you need to call. And for anybody else who's thinking it might be, let me give you a quick recap. In the early morning hours of June 7th, 1992, Stacy McCall and Susie Streeter returned to Susie's home located at 1717 East Delmar Street in Springfield, Missouri, after a night of graduation celebrations. Sometime between 2:15 a.m. and 8 a.m., Susie, Stacy, and Susie's mother, Cheryl Levitt, were abducted from their house. More than 33 years later, all three women are still missing. If you have any information in this case, please call the Springfield Police Department at 417-864-1810 or Crime Stoppers at 417-869-8477. There is a $43,000 reward available. I really hope that if you have anything, you make that phone call. My final words, as always, go out to the friends and family of Stacy, Susie, and Cheryl. I'm thinking about you guys. 33 years later, no family should have to wait that long for answers and to have to go through your life not knowing if your loved one is still out there somewhere hoping that you'll find them. That's a feeling I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy. And I know that after all these years, it's probably still very difficult to listen or watch coverage on this case. But I hope that you see it for what it is, a call to action. I don't want people to forget about this case. They may know the name Springfield 3, but not know the details of what actually happened and what pieces of evidence we do have to work with. My hope is that by covering this over and over for as long as it takes, eventually we'll get you guys the answers you deserve and we'll finally bring your family members home. And when that day finally comes, I'll be sitting right here making you all aware that we finally know what happened to the Springfield 3. Until then, everyone stay safe out there, and I'll see you soon.
Cool. Quick, choose a meal deal with McValue. The $5 McChicken meal deal, the $5 McDouble meal deal, or the new $6 Daily Double meal deal. Each with its own small fries, drink, and four-piece McNuggets. It's actually no rush. I'm just excited for McDonald's.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Not valid for McDelivery.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No